Anybody who wants to be successful in research has to learn to like failure.
Oh, gosh.
Every time I went to a maker fair, I just said, these are my people. He's so cool. He's like, I can't even believe he's a person. He seems completely mechanical.
This is Brain Inspired.
Welcome, everyone. I am Paul Middlebrooks. I'm your host for the Brain Inspired podcast. You again heard the voice of Dr. Stephen Potter there at the beginning. Today is the second part of my conversation with Steve. If you missed the first part, I recommend listening to the last episode to get caught up, because in this one, we start right in talking about the embodied cultured networks that he created. That is, he used these networks to research how real neurons could both listen to signals from the outside world, much like sensing, learn how to alter their own activity, to then send out commands to control a robot, all from a wet little petri dish. So we talk about how they got those things to work, and we dive pretty deep into one of the papers from his lab and discuss the ins and outs of how they controlled their robot with the neurons. And we go on to talk about a ton of other stuff, like the rising importance of citizen science, and how you, dear listener, could become a maker and usher in the next paradigm shift in how we study brains. So this episode is longer than the first one, but if you liked the first episode, you'll like this one just as much, if not more. Again, links to what we talk about are on the website at braininspired.co. If you have questions for me, maybe a recommendation for who I should have on the show, reach out to me on Twitter. I am at PGMID, that is PGMID, or you could search for Paul Middlebrooks, I suppose. Okay, here's the rest of my conversation with Steve Potter. I want to go down a little bit deeper into your cultured embodied networks, or your hybrots. And by the way, hybrots, H-Y-B-R-O-T-S, I'm really tired of autocorrect changing it to hybrid every time I type it.
You have to just right-click on it and select learn.
Now I'm going to have to do that right after we get off here now. So this was your main thrust in your research program at Georgia Tech. Most people have an animal system, and then they study the animal system, and then they'll create a model, you know, computer model, and then they'll run the model, and then they'll compare it to the animal system, and they go on a loop there. And then they research the animal system more, and then they tweak the model. You started with a living model, essentially, and then you use that model to probe what can be done in a closed loop system. And so it was an interesting approach. Do you have something to add to that?
I was going to say it's really important to note that it's a semi-living model. You know, that we created the word hybrid means it's like a hybrid robot. And in fact, what it actually wasn't me who coined that term. It was my colleague Bill Ditto when he was a professor at Georgia Tech. He suggested the word to describe the robots that we were controlling with living neurons. So to me, a hybrid means specifically a robot that's controlled by living neurons. And we also worked a lot with living neurons controlling simulated animals. So we call those neurally controlled animats.
Yeah, another autocorrect fun word. And by the way, yeah, I saw a talk you gave, I guess your TEDx talk, where you essentially had to define neuroengineering because it's not in the dictionary, and you give examples of the autofills that come up when you type neuroengineering. Hybrot, not in the dictionary yet, correct?
I don't think so.
Yeah, okay.
There's only a few labs in the world, I could probably count them on one hand, who are working with actual hybrots.
So let's talk about cultured embodied networks. So you take, well, what you did, and I don't know if everyone does it this way, is you took 18-day-old rat neurons, cortical neurons, is that correct?
Usually they were from embryonic day 18. So a rat's gestation is 21 days. And if you get the cortex out of a rat at day 18, out of a rat fetus, I should say, then the cells that you get are mostly neurons. The glia haven't divided that much, so it was a way of, and also they grow very well in culture even after dissociating them. So the way people make neural cell cultures is they take brain tissue and they soak it in some enzyme that kind of breaks apart the connections between the cells, and then you squirt it with turbulence through a little pipette, and that's called dissociation, and it's pretty violent ripping all the neurons apart, and they just form little balls after that. And when you put them in a dish and they rain down onto the surface of the dish through the medium, they immediately take hold of the dish and start to grow their axons and dendrites again, if they had any in the embryo, which they might or they might not.
And are they, I used to do slice work as a technician with early mouse brain slices, and so I should know this. How differentiated are the cells at that point?
They're not that well differentiated. So there's rats are born quite prematurely. You know, they're kind of like mm-hmm. a second term premature human. Their eyes aren't open. They can basically only suck the nipples and get milk. There's not much else they can do at that age. And so they have some circuits that are obviously working for squeaking and drinking milk, but really can't do much else. And we found that a lot of the neurons could change whether they are inhibitory or excitatory, depending on what kind of activity patterns they went through in the dish. So they were obviously still even deciding big questions that a neuron faces during development of, should I become inhibitory or excitatory? So there's probably a lot more subtleties going on there. And there probably are levels, different parts of the brain that are much further along in its differentiation. But the cortex, you know, you could think of it as the general purpose part of the brain, the one that gets co-opted to do a lot of tricky things that are contingent on what the animal does. And since it hasn't experienced much, there's not a lot of differentiating going on in the fetus there.
Okay, so you take these cells, you dissociate them, and then you pump them into a petri dish, a culture dish, which has a substrate in it. And the bottom there are, you used an 8x8 minus 4 electrodes, so there were 60 electrodes that these cells would settle down and form a monolayer. So it was a single layer of cells, and they would randomly, at their own behest, settle down on top of this layer of electrodes. So you would do that day one, and then it would take, about a week for them to settle down and start to connect and produce action potentials and activity?
Yeah, so they form connections probably within the first few days. So I've made a lot of time-lapse movies of them during the first few days in culture. And one of the things that I noticed was that they were often making tentative connections with each other, that they would reach out with their dendrites or axons, or we just call them neurites when we don't know whether it's a dendrite or an axon input or an output. We just say the neurites. They'd reach out with their neurites and oftentimes pull it away and reach out to another neuron. So I think there's a lot of wiring that they were doing there that isn't random, that they have a certain developmental program that they are trying to follow as best they can in this strange environment of a culture dish. And that they probably can smell or taste each other and say, this is the right kind of neuron I'm supposed to be connected to, and I'm going to make a connection here. So when you say that it's a monolayer, it wasn't really. Once the thing is mature, it's probably more like three cells thick, but it's close to a monolayer. In the brain, it's obviously a very three-dimensional structure. But you could imagine that three-dimensional structure is still there in terms of its connectivity, even in a monolayer, because the axons are passing over and under each other and forming quite a complicated three-dimensional network, even in a flat culture dish in what we call a monolayer culture. It's quite a complicated three-dimensional structure, which might have 3D topology to it. So I was going to, you know, try to emphasize when people say, it's a random network, it's only a monolayer, it's not very, very organotypic, brain-like, that may or may not be true.
Right. Yeah, because when reading your papers, one of the things I thought of immediately is the cortical column and how purportedly important that is to computation in the brain, and how seemingly a culture like yours would lack that structure. But I hadn't thought of them forming what could be essentially that structure on their own without actually being in that morphological structure. So that's interesting.
Yeah, so think of there's an example that suggests that this definitely can happen, which is people with hydrocephalus sometimes have been discovered fairly late in life. You know, they might have had a slightly bigger head than normal.
So hydrocephalus is when it's water on the brain is what it translates to, and people swell, and then that changes the shape of your brain, essentially.
Yeah, so most importantly, it makes the ventricles, which are open, fluid-filled spaces in the brain that are in everybody's brain, it makes the ventricles get bigger and bigger and bigger, and it pushes the rest of the brain tissue up against the skull. And in some people, they found whose behavior was quite normal. You know, they could learn to speak, they could read and write and all that. They found that their whole brain was only a centimeter thick, squished up against the skull. Mm. So it was obviously completely distorted, and its three-dimensional structure was probably just ruined by this hydrocephalus. And yet they still could process information just fine. So I don't know if that's due to lots of extra plasticity they had or due to the fact that they had the right connectivity, three-dimensional connectivity in topology, but maybe not in actual geometry.
That's interesting. Okay, so you have this culture now, and you're continually feeding it nutrients and keeping it clean so that it doesn't get infected with anything from the outside world. So you're doing all this in a vent hood. It's a thin layer, not a monolayer, but it's a thin layer, and you can therefore look at it under a microscope and watch the shapes of the cells over time and their connections as they're reaching out the neurites, like you said. And you also have a way to send it input, like sensory input, by stimulating using the electrodes underneath on the substrate. Those same electrodes can be used to listen to the neurons and output their activity. And the way you do this is you connect that Petri dish to a computer. Well, maybe you'll do a better job describing the setup of the closed loop scenario.
Yeah, you're doing a very good job. I should maybe back up a little bit and mention something more about the animals to animats thing. You know, I really was inculcated in the idea of the importance of embodiment back then, back in the 90s. And I don't think learning really has any definition unless it's embodied. You know, if you talk about a neural network growing in a dish whose synapses are changing, and it's not embodied in some way, I call that plasticity, or I might call it synaptic alterations or something else. But I would not ever call that learning until you have something that can behave and you see that behavior change in a lasting way. That's how I would define learning. And so we really felt like it was important to embody these cultured networks if we were going to say we want to watch the learning happen under the microscope. You know, in a culture dish all by itself, I don't think there is learning happening. There may be plasticity, there definitely is plasticity, but to call it learning and for it to be really interesting to other neuroscientists who study animals or people, I think you really need to have behavior of some sort. So we worked really, really hard at figuring out how could we get the motor signals, which are the recordings you make from the neurons, to translate those into something that could control either a robot or a little simulation that's running around on the computer in a simulated environment, or an animat, that's what we call an animat. How to get those motor signals to control it in an interesting way. So that's the motor mapping. And then what should we do to send sensory input back into the culture dish? So this animat or this robot that we've connected it to has some sensory system, and we have to take those sensory signals, you know, let's just say it's a robot with a little ultrasonic rangefinder on it. We have to take those pings from the rangefinder and translate them into little electrical shocks that we deliver to the culture dish. And when we started this project, which was around 1999, or 98, there didn't exist any circuitry for us to do that, or let alone software. You know, even the hardware to stimulate all of the cells in the dish wasn't there. We bought multi-electrode arrays from a company called Multi-Channel Systems, and they had a beautiful recording setup, but they had very rudimentary stimulation setup. You could only pick 8 electrodes, and you had to actually physically plug them in to change channels. And so one of the first things we did, and when I say we, I mean my first postdoc, Tom DeMars, and my first graduate student, Daniel Vakhanar. These were the two masterminds in the lab who built the first all-channel stimulators. So this, you could say, is the the sensory mapping system, the technology that made sensory mapping enabled for these culture dishes, allowed us to take whatever sensory signals the animat or the robot has and deliver them to whatever electrode we want as quick as we want, and to change the patterns of stimulation as much as we want to deliver really complex, interesting stimuli back to these culture dishes, not just, you know, standard neuroscience way of dealing with stimulation in slices is called tetanic stimulation, where you're basically just zapping the hell out of them with an oscillating signal. You know, it's just a 40 hertz oscillation of pulses. It's not very interesting. It's great at inducing plasticity, but it doesn't carry much information. And we wanted to study learning and information processing. So I said, we're going to have to make better stimulators here. And so those guys, Daniel made one called Rax that has been used in lots of labs now. And Daniel Vakhanar wrote something called MayaBench software, which allowed us to control our experiments and do the real-time feedback that we needed to do. So it basically made it possible to close the loop so that the cells could fire, take that information, process it in real-time in the computer. He had it running on a Linux machine with a real-time kernel, and that information then was fed right back into the dish with this all-channel stimulator that he built, and that Tom DeMars also built another version of it. And once we did that, we then had an animat that could run around in its environment and just learn from experience, you know, just go around and see what it does.
This sounds all simple, right? You put the cells in the culture and you let them settle. First of all, I'm wondering, you know, out of 10 attempted cultures, how many make it to a state where you can record from them and stimulate them?
All of our cultures produce signals. Like unless we did something wrong, like they got infected, every single culture that we plated had fantastic signals.
Get out of here. Come on, man.
They all did, every single one. And that took, that wasn't right at the beginning. It took a couple of important things, technological advances, for us to pull that off. So right at the beginning, I learned that the medium that a lot of people grow neural cultures in, which is defined medium. Defined means that you know what every ingredient is in the medium. It turns out wasn't very good. It was optimized to make cells look nice. The company that sells it did a lot of studies on the morphology of cells, and they grew beautifully. But when you recorded from them, they had almost no activity. And other people who were successful with slices were using medium that is not defined because it has serum in it, which is blood without the blood cells. And so in serum, there's so many different ingredients. We just say it's undefined. We don't know what all is in there. We know there's lots of good stuff. Some of that stuff, it turns out, was really important for our cultures to be happy. So we always included serum in the medium. And as soon as we did that, activity was just all over the place. Another thing that people tend to do, which we only played around with a little bit, is to reduce the number of glia in the cultures. They complain about glia overgrowing the cultures because, unlike neurons, they divide a lot. And it turns out are important. Neurons aren't very happy without glial cells. Surprise, surprise. Whenever we grew cultures in which we tried to get rid of the glia by, say, killing any cell that divides with a mitosis inhibitor, the neurons were very unhappy. So that was an important lesson we learned early on in Jerry Pine's lab, which was just let the glia grow as much as they want. The neurons, they need to touch them too. That's another interesting thing we learned, that it's fine to have conditioned medium that you got from glial cultures and pour it on the neurons. They're a little bit better off that way, but they're much better if they're actually touching glial cells. Or even to have them in the same dish as the neurons, but not touching it. Sometimes we put glial cells out in the periphery of the dish, and the neurons in the middle just weren't very happy. And as soon as they were connected to the glial monolayer, the neurons grew like crazy.
Wow,
those were two important things. A third important thing, so the first thing was don't use defined medium, use medium that contains serum and has lots of stuff in it. The second one was let the cells touch glia, let glia grow. The third thing was something that I think still isn't appreciated very much in neurocultures, which is the osmolarity of the medium. We very carefully maintain that using some gas permeable membranes that I made into lids that I actually have a patent for. Never made any money off of that, but it was a revolution in our lab in allowing us to culture neural cultures for the oldest one lived 2 years. And that one, Tom DeMars, did not baby. He did many experiments on that culture in those 2 years. And it just kept growing because he took very good care of it. And because we sealed the dish up with this Teflon membrane, and that prevented the culture medium from getting too salty by evaporation. So people don't realize that every time they open their incubator, all the humid air that's in there goes out, cells dry out a little bit, and the medium they're in gets a little bit saltier and saltier. And if you were to do that to a person, you know, that's basically the same thing as putting them out in the Mojave Desert and making them die of thirst. You know, if your blood gets even a little bit above, 300 milliosmos of osmolarity, you are an unhappy camper and you are dead pretty soon. And the same thing goes for cultured networks, but people really weren't appreciating that because they just don't routinely measure how salty is the medium they're growing the cells in.
Are you describing all this? I mean, it really reminds me how delicate a lot of this work is and how many different moving parts have to work together in conjunction for it all to work out. And sure, you got 10 out of 10 plates to thrive. Is there an area in all of this process where did you have any failures? Did anything set you back? And what did you do to overcome it?
Yeah, I think anybody who wants to be successful in research has to learn to like failure. So failure is pretty much the norm. 90% of the time everything fails, and 10% of the time you succeed and then you publish a paper. So one way to deal with this is to publish, which we did, in the Journal of Negative Results. You know, we have a paper in which it describes in great detail all of the experiments that Daniel Vakhanar did to try to induce some kind of learning in these cultured networks and how they all failed.
Just as an aside, that's not one I came across. So I guess, you know, we preach that negative results are just as important, but maybe we don't practice it quite enough yet because I didn't come across that paper.
There should be more journals of negative results, but it's a great journal, actually. It's a very high-quality journal, and they loved our paper. It's very, very well cited because a lot of people are also having a hard time getting learning in cultured networks, and they say, we couldn't do it. Well, neither could Potter's lab. Of course, if you read our later papers, it turns out we succeeded. And the question is, how did we do it, and what was the problem that Daniel was having? It wasn't a simple problem. It was a very tricky problem. These cultures, because you're putting them in basically in sensory deprivation most of the time, you're putting them in an incubator with no connection. We don't normally have them hooked up to the computer. So they're not getting stimulation. And when cells do that, they go a little bit crazy due to kind of plasticity we call homeostatic plasticity. So you could think of it this way. The cells evolve to get input. They're not getting enough input, so they're turning up the gain on their inputs louder and louder and louder. And then all of a sudden you have a network that's hyper excitable. It's too twitchy. And the slightest little spontaneous signal that happens in the network becomes an avalanche of action potentials that goes across the network, and basically every cell in the dish fires a big burst. And if you hook it up to a loudspeaker, it goes And so we call it a barrage or a burst of action potentials or a dish-wide burst. These things are very similar to what you measure if you put an electrode into somebody who's having a seizure. So brains naturally become like this when they're not getting inputs. So if some tissue has been cut off from its input because you had a car accident, or, for example, another example of these what's called deafferentation syndrome, your periphery in your hearing is not working anymore, the auditory cortex starts to create artificial signals called tinnitus, which are ringing in the ears, or in some cases, it's noises that when I've heard people describe it, they describe it as sounding just like the signals in our culture dishes. You know, this is sort of, you say it sounds like a train crashing, and that's exactly what it sounds like if you hook up our dishes to an audio amplifier. It sounds a lot like a train crashing. So neural tissue can become hyper-excitable if it doesn't get enough inputs. And these bursts, it turns out, dish wide bursts were erasing any kind of learning that we were trying to put into the culture dishes. Tom DeMars and Dan Evakinar and a few other people in the lab all tried really hard to get learning to work, and we failed and we failed and we failed. And it wasn't until we got rid of the bursts that we succeeded. We finally succeeded. And the way we did that was we decided to bring them out of their sensory deprivation and sprinkle a background level of activity on them by stimulating them. And when we did that, we had a culture that never did these bursts, or we could tweak it. We actually had a closed loop feedback system that was tweaking the stimulation constantly to adjust it. So they're getting just the right amount of stimulation that it was preventing the burst, but still allowing them to take in other inputs and learn something.
How much time did that set you back?
Well, that was a pretty much a 10-year learning process.
Yeah.
And I wanted to point out this, there's a book about that. So one of my colleagues at Georgia Tech, Wendy Neustetter, is an ethologist who studies the scientific method. And so she and her friends wrote a book that includes about four different labs and how they do discovery in science.
Cool.
They were in our lab for like 5 years with their clipboards, studying us like lab rats, figuring out how do we make discoveries? How do we deal with failure? How do we come up with the next idea to study? How do we deal with bad data, good data? You know, all that stuff was documented by her in great detail. And some of that made it into this book. We're lab D. We were an anonymous lab number D who was studying hybrids at Georgia Tech.
You didn't have enough pressure with grant writing and all the rest. You needed someone looking over your shoulder as well, huh?
Well, they were very friendly. They ended up getting sucked into the lab because they came to all our lab meetings, and they became great friends with everybody in the lab. So we actually liked them. It was probably, you know, fraternizing with the scientists was probably not as good scientific method if you're doing biology. But if you're doing ethology, I guess that's okay. So my lab kind of has this strange two-sided feeling about these dish-wide bursts. In one respect, they represent a huge problem that we tried to get rid of, and we did successfully get rid of them. And when we did manage to demonstrate learning, which we could talk about later. But you could also say that we made the NIH very happy because I had a long-lasting collaboration with a functional neurosurgeon, Bob Gross, at Emory University. He routinely does surgeries on people who have horrible, intractable epilepsy. And those people have tried all the different drugs, it doesn't work, and their only option is to remove a large chunk of their brain. And often that leaves them disabled in various ways. So he would much rather do something that's reversible and less invasive, and we together concluded that maybe we could try the same stimulation that we're giving our culture dishes and put that in epileptic people's brains that would sprinkle a little bit of stimulation there contingent on how much activity was going on and prevent the tissue from ever becoming epileptic. And I'm proud to say that he's got a huge grant to pursue that. He's continuing to pursue that at Emory University. And one of our shared former graduate students, Sharanya Desai, is now working for NeuroPace in the Bay Area, who's building implantable epilepsy devices. So she's taking the ideas that she learned from his lab and applying them to actual epilepsy treatments. So although this was a problem for us, you could say that our solution of the problem could be a benefit for other things. The reason why we kind of like burst in some ways is that when we study them in great detail, we classify them. We threw them through an artificial neural network, and this is with Zoltan Adazdi. And it classified them, and it found all sorts of interesting attractors in their dynamics. So the bursts, basically, you could think of them as being OCD behavior, that when a burst happens, the network expresses a similar trajectory of activity that it expressed previously. And we could actually map all these trajectories using all of our multi-electrode arrays, and then we classified them using various clustering algorithms, and we found that they fell into different clusters, and that the networks expressed the same things over and over and over again. So that was actually the first plasticity we successfully did, was to say, okay, we've got networks that express bursts A through B, A through Z, 26 different interesting bursts. And now we're zapping them with a strong stimulation, and we saw that they changed. The repertoire of bursts that they exhibited was different. You know, but to me, that was a very boring kind of learning because it didn't have any information in the tetanic stimulation we delivered. It was just a zapping, very strong zapping stimulation to induce plasticity. So later on, we got much more nuanced with our stimulation.
Were you using the background stimulation when you trained the artist known as Meert?
Yeah, Mayart.
Mayart. Oh, pardon me. So this is one of your more famous examples, I suppose. And this is where you had one of your cultured systems connected via the internet to two robotic arms that you would install drawing utensils with. And the output from the culture dish would be sent over the internet to Australia. And it would send signals on what to draw, how to draw. And then video of the drawing would be sent back through the internet and fed back into the system via stimulation. And I should say that at least in one version of this, the input was, it would be constantly getting input on with visual faces. Is that correct? Portrait faces to be drawn? That was the goal?
Right. So this thing traveled the world, the body of Mayart anyway, traveled the world at various different art exhibits. And Doug Bachum, the grad student who was running most of our side of the experiment, got to travel to all sorts of exotic locales. and actually the second version of it called Silent Barrage was exhibited here in Ireland for a while at the Science Gallery in Dublin. But that thing, it was getting feedback that represented somebody's face, a picture of a person in the gallery. And Silent Barrage was getting feedback of people walking through the exhibit. So that version of it had a whole room full of these robots that were pillars with paper on them. And a robot would spin around the pillar and draw on it and move up and down the pillar. And the height that it moved was determined by how much activity that electrode was recording at any given moment. So as the people walked through the exhibit, the cameras were watching them, and they would cause stimulation of the network, and that would cause the robots to start moving and changing their drawings on these pillars. So it was a very interactive kind of exhibit that we called Silent Barrage. The barrage word comes from those bursts of activity that spread across the dishes every so often.
Oh, I see.
So I should mention the first version of Mayart, you're asking about whether we had quieted the bursts in Mayart. We didn't. And in fact, you could even credit Mayart as leading us to the solution. It was the first time that we had a network that was connected continuously for days on end. You know, we had these art exhibits going, and so for a whole month we were stimulating the culture dish. And we noticed that those dishes were much, much quieter than all the other dishes that we would pull out of the incubator every day and plug them in and start recording from them. And those ones were epileptic. And the ones that were connected to Mayart were nice and quiet and well-behaved. And we said, hey, there's something interesting going on here. Maybe it's because we keep on stimulating them all the time. They are not so hyper-excitable.
That's cool. I did not realize that. But the output, at least of Mayart, would you characterize it more akin to a Mona Lisa or a Jackson Pollock piece?
Yeah, definitely, it's more of a Jackson Pollock piece. That has a lot to do with the mechanics of Mayart. It wasn't it wasn't designed to be like a CNC mill, you know, that the signals you send into it aren't necessarily what you get out of it. So even if you try to control it perfectly with fake signals, the drawing still wasn't very good. And then when you add in the randomness of living neural networks, what you get is an interesting scribble. And what I could say is that every culture dish had different interesting scribbles. And I could say that even when presented with a different person's face, they would produce different kinds of scribbles. So they were in some sense drawing portraits of the person in the gallery, but they were pretty, I would say, abstract art.
Yeah, that's so cool though. So let's move forward just a little bit. I want to talk a little bit more in detail about one of the papers that you guys published. And this was a system where you were trying to train a robot to go toward the center of a big circle, and good behavior was moving toward the center, and bad behavior was moving away from the center. And you're using these cultured networks in the closed loop system to try to train this robot. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that sounds like the Zanis Chow's paper from 2008 or so.
So the setup is interesting to me. So you have a few different ways that you're stimulating the cultured network. One is called context control probing sequence. And if I understand this correctly, you had six little stimulations that you delivered to the dish, and that was to quiet the bursting activity so that when you then delivered a what you call a probe stimulation that you used to output, to move the robot, that the background activity would be quiet enough that it could accept this stimulation and produce a viable movement.
I suppose the best way to think of that is calling attention, to ask the culture dish, hey, pay attention. We're about to stimulate you and ask you a question, which way to move. I know there's a lot going on in the dish at any given moment of its own little internal conversation, its own internal dialogue, or monologue, I suppose. And we wanted to stop that for a second, or for maybe about 200 milliseconds, by sending in a pre-sequence, this context stimulation, and then to ask it to pay attention. Then we're going to send in a probe, which is a stimulation that says, which way should we move? And I guess one of the things that we realized was that we could put information into the attention signal. So we could say, in the attention signal, we could use four different ones, and say, attention, you just did the wrong thing to the left last time. You know, which way should we move now? You know, that's kind of the question we were asking the network by sending in electrical pulses in various sequences.
Okay, so you have that probe pulse. So it's a sequence of six stimulations, and those are the same throughout training, so that you know, like, any change that's happening is happening via plasticity within the culture dish.
Yeah.
So you send then the probe pulse, which generates the movement signal. So you generate the probe pulse and you record for 100 milliseconds after you send that pulse in. And you use that 100 milliseconds of recording to generate the movement sequence to move the robot.
That's right. Yeah, we kind of took the activity across the network in that 100 milliseconds after the probe pulse. So that's a tenth of a second. And we did what's kind of like a center of gravity. We call it center of activity. So you can imagine if you're balancing a tray on your hand and somebody puts a cup on one corner of it, you have to move your hand over towards there to get it to balance again. And that's, you're putting your hand where the center of gravity is of that tray with all of its cups on it. So our dish is kind of like that. It's got each electrode recording a certain amount of activity. We could say that each spike has a certain amount of weight, and that somewhere in the dish there is the center of activity where all of the activity levels on the different electrodes balance out. And in fact, you could say that there's a trajectory. As the time goes on after the probe pulse, that center of activity moves because the activity is traveling through lots of different neurons in different ways. So we took all those center of activity trajectories and classified them and used those as commands to tell the Animat to move this way or that way.
I see. So then the Animat would move using that population coding. And the second type of stimulation that you used were called pattern training stimulation. And these were stimulations that you would repeat six stimulations that lasted about 4 seconds each time you repeated it. And there were 100 different PTSs, these were called, that were randomly selected. And the idea here is that when you stimulate using these pattern training stimuli, it induces synaptic plasticity in the cultured network.
That's absolutely correct, yeah.
And then the last type of stimulation that you're delivering is a background stimulation, like you were talking about before, to keep the seizure type activity, the bursting activity, to a minimum.
Yeah, you really delved into the subtleties of this paper. So this is Bachem and Chow's paper, I think, from 2008 also. So Doug Bachem and Zanis Chow worked hand in hand on these projects, and they really did some amazing things here. And I think their huge breakthrough was in coming up with this patterned training stimulation. We knew that the tetanic stimulation, the very strong zapping, just boring 40 hertz oscillation
worked. But as I said before, that doesn't carry much information. And I kept saying, can't we stimulate with some patterns that carry lots of information? You know, some distributed spatiotemporal pattern, like the way real brain circuits get from our sensory systems. And they tried to do that. And their great innovation was to just create a random set of these. You mentioned 100 or so PTSs that they just created out of thin air, out of their imaginations. But they then had this clever idea of having an evolutionary algorithm going on in the computer that would change which ones get used more often. So as the network learned and we saw some patterns working better than others, their ranking went up in the list, and they got used more often. And as some pattern either didn't work in training the network or somehow made it learn the wrong thing, that pattern got used less and less. So this is a way of shuffling the preponderance of different patterns that we delivered to the networks as the thing learned. And this was the real breakthrough that made this whole experiment work, was using an evolutionary algorithm on the computer to decide which learning patterns we ought to use more of. And the point about the background stimulation, we wanted to make it, I guess, statistically similar to the PTSs. We didn't want it to be too overwhelming or too quiet. If it was too quiet, they would have these big dish-wide bursts that might be erasing some of the memories. And if it were too strong, then the random stimulation might be causing some training that we weren't expecting. I'm not sure we found the perfect balance there. You know, the learning that we induced lasted, when you stop training it, for about an hour and a half. That was the longest we could get it to last. And I suspect that's because the random stimulation we were delivering during the resting periods was erasing some of the memories that we had trained into the culture dish. So what you would need to do to get it to learn permanently, I don't know, but I think probably this is exactly the role of the hippocampus in the human brain or in mammals' brains, that their job is to take recently learned memories and keep on reactivating those circuits over and over again until the synapses are all strengthened elsewhere in the brain, in the cortex or whatever other parts of the brain were necessary for that learning process.
The take home for me is that, and one of the beautiful things about this is that you used so much random input, random patterns of stimulation, random background noise, and yet the system, which you weren't training on specific algorithms, you were just using the feedback from the robotic system to semi-randomly input stimulations into the system, and then if it improved, you used that stimulation again, and if it didn't improve, you didn't, and it learned. So you had a semi-living culture dish that learned, and it essentially it worked.
Yeah, it took a lot of repetitions of those patterns. You know, I think most of the learning took on the order of half an hour to really be strong and to be obvious. So we have trajectories in our papers that show you how the Animat was moving kind of randomly at the beginning and then eventually started to go in just the right direction that we had specified at the beginning of the experiment. I think that's really key, that this was the first time that anybody had taken a culture dish and said ahead of time, before they trained it, here's what it's going to do when I'm finished training it. You know, there's a lot of people who had induced plasticity and get the network to change in some way, but they didn't pre-specify what that change was going to be. So we were the first to say, we're going to have an Animat move to the northwest when this training is finished. At the beginning, it's moving completely randomly, and we zap it with these repetitive patterns, and we keep shuffling the order of which patterns we stimulate. Interestingly, during the learning process, sometimes a pattern that worked stops working, and we have to keep reshuffling the patterns to keep up with the network as it learns. So a different pattern now might be needed to learn the second half of whatever the task was.
I just realized the point, too, that, you know, when someone's training an artificial network, say a deep learning network, time is not an issue because you just run it as fast as you can. But when you're training a semi-living cultured network, you have to wait for the learning to happen. And it's impressive how quickly that learning did happen.
Yeah, well, we didn't give it a very difficult task to do. You know, a navigation task was very simple. We were dying to do much more exciting and complicated tasks. And the few that we tried, like training it to do two different things at the same time, weren't very successful. The results were not very obvious. They weren't statistically significant. But we have high hopes that if we had continued along this pathway, when other groups do follow these protocols that we published, they'll be able to generalize them into much more tricky tasks. I think the big problem with why, you know, it's not really having to wait for the network to learn. I suspect that you could probably train a network to learn relatively quickly based on how well animals, even very simple animals, learn in just a few seconds, all sorts of things. So I think that the physiology is there. The cells are doing interesting things within just a few seconds. The problem is really the bandwidth. Our interface to these networks through 60 electrodes was fairly pathetic, you know, there's usually on the order of 20 to 50,000 neurons in there. So we're just getting a very tiny subsampling of the activity going on in the networks. So it's kind of like saying, you know, I've got a room full of geniuses here, but I'm going to only let them use their left hand, or if they're left-handed, you only use their right hand to write one letter on a piece of paper and put all those through a mail slot and take what junk comes out of the mail slot of scribbles from geniuses using their wrong hand, a bunch of letters from each genius, and trying to say, okay, what were they trying to tell me? What was this room of geniuses trying to tell me here? You know, that's kind of what we were doing there. The answer is probably the geniuses are going, why did they get what we were trying to say? You know, the answer is the bandwidth was pathetic. The future is going to be optical. We did some fantastic, the last papers published before I closed my lab at Georgia Tech were optogenetics papers where we sent in the stimuli optically instead of electrically. We still recorded electrically, but I think eventually we were hoping to do voltage-sensitive dyes, but there's some technical problems there. And probably eventually there are going to be other approaches, optical approaches, from recording large numbers of neural activity in these culture dishes, even in intact animals, perhaps. One of the cool things about optical recording and stimulation is it's much easier to do in a living animal or a person than it is with electrodes. Optical stimulation can be cell type specific. You can use different colors of light to stimulate different cells. You can make it inhibitory so it actually turns off certain cells and turns on others. And the electrodes have a problem being rejected by the tissue, but glass fibers aren't so problematic in that respect. So fiber optics are probably going to be in all of us at some day, enhancing our brains with various kinds of stimulation and recording using closed loop systems.
I'm tempted to go down the optogenetic road here, but I'm really aware of our time that I've been taking up so much of your time. Okay, since this is a podcast about the convergence of neuroscience and AI, just as a thought experiment, I'm wondering how feasible it is or would be to use one of these cultured embodied networks to set it up so that it resembles more or less an artificial deep learning kind of network. It seems like we're really far away from being able to layer the neurons like that and have them connect in certain ways. I wonder if something like that would inform us a little bit more about what's going on in the AI deep learning networks, although there's a lot of headway being made into opening that black box already as well, or if that would just be a complete waste of another 10 years of someone's time trying to do something like that.
Yeah, well, there are people that are doing that, and you know, people who I love and respect and have collaborated with, even trying to make something that looks just like a Hopfield recurrent neural network, for example, or a back layers of backprop network. I think that this is a waste of time myself. I think there's a number of reasons. First one, you could think of this as being kind of silly because. A good example is let's think about dancers called pop lockers. You know, if you go on YouTube and look up pop lockers who are dancing the robot, you know, they're making these movements that are really cool and impressive because you look at them and you say, whoa, he's totally like a robot. He's so cool. He's like, I can't even believe he's a person. He seems completely mechanical, you know. And what he's doing is he is very carefully and skillfully imitating all of the bad aspects of robots that we have with our current bad robot technology. All the fact that they have jerk and they have poor acceleration profiles, and that they oscillate, they shake, and they move. Just the way they move is so non-lifelike, it's ridiculous. It's a long way off from being convincingly real, and it's so different than the way humans move and the way animals move that a dancer can make a lot of money on the street by putting their hat out and dancing like that.
I had no idea that you found my YouTube videos of my wedding dance, but
pop locking the robot. So I would say that to grow cultured neurons in a dish and make them like an artificial neural network is just like a guy dancing the robot. You know, that you're trying to imitate something that's highlighting our ignorance of, or our poor understanding of how brains work. You know, that here you've got a model, an artificial neural network, which is lame and pathetic and not very brain-like, and let's try to imitate it with real neurons, which are very sophisticated devices of their own. It just seems silly to me.
Got it. You've written that the computers of tomorrow will be created by a new breed of cross-disciplinary engineer scientists who are experts not only in machine learning, but also in neurobiology. Machine learning, artificial intelligence is a huge field. Neuroscience is a huge field. The time of Renaissance persons, I'll say to be politically correct these days, you might say, although you foot that bill pretty well as a modern Renaissance man, but it's so hard to learn that much material. If you were going to give someone advice who's thinking about getting into one or the other, how would you advise someone to approach the study of neuroscience and artificial intelligence?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think that the times have really changed in the last few years. Even though it may still not be in dictionary.com, neuroengineering is a real word. There's a Journal of Neuroengineering. There are departments, although the neuroengineering laboratory that I was part of at Georgia Tech, I think, was the first one. There's now lots of neuroengineering laboratories all around the world. So my advice is, if you do care to wed AI and neuroscience, to get into neuroengineering, I think it's much, much easier to go from the direction of biology towards computer science as you get more skillful and as you go through graduate school, for example, than it is if you were to, say, become a computer scientist and try to learn neuroscience after the fact. I honestly cannot think of anybody who's done that, who is now successful at both of them. You know, I'm sure there are such examples, but I honestly can't think of who that might be right now. And I'm pretty well connected in the fields. In both fields, that there are quite a few computer scientists who are conversant in neurobiology, but, you know, that's a different thing than really understanding it the way you do when you take a neurobiology degree and go through grad school and learn neurobiology, all the neurobiology you learn, you know, dissecting animals and recording from their brains and whatnot. So I think another reason why I say go into a neuroengineering department or a neuroengineering program is because if you just went into straight neurobiology program, you might not be forced to actually build some equipment and to try to solve problems. So it's quite possible that there are some people out there that would be happy to just do neuroscience to gain more knowledge. As I said at the outset here, I don't think that's the reason why we do science. I think we do it to solve problems. And even if our knowledge is incomplete, we can still solve quite a few interesting problems. So going to neuroengineering, where you'll be surrounded by people who are solving real problems. And that will force you to build some equipment. You'll learn electronics. It'll probably force you to do some computer programming to run all of your equipment and to crunch the data. And once you get into big data, you know, you'll be crunching masses of data if you're doing anything with neurons, because they produce lots of data. As soon as you start crunching masses of data, you're going to start needing tricky AI to help you do that, probably.
Yeah.
So you're going to learn all of that AI stuff as a consequence of trying to do standard neuroengineering, the kind of stuff that we did in my lab on a daily basis, you're going to learn all that. If you go into computer science lab, you will have a room full of computer terminals. There won't be any equipment. There's no cells growing. There's no fume hoods. There's no shelves covered with chemicals. You probably aren't going to learn enough neurobiology to do the kind of thing that we're talking about here with your podcast.
I've noticed a lot of the people who are touching on or who are using AI algorithms and networks to study neural systems these days come from a physics background. Did you have students coming through your lab who had physics backgrounds? You came through as in biochemistry and neurobiology, but you just happen to be well versed in creating things and you seem to, you probably had a pretty strong physics background yourself, but it seems like a lot of the dynamical systems theory that people learn in physical systems really has benefited them in applying it to neuroscience problems. I'm wondering if you agree with that.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. There are some of the best neural network modelers came from physics background. You know, John Hopfield is one of them. Both of my postdoc advisors were from physics background. So Jerry Pine was a high energy physicist up until the 70s when he invented multi-electrode arrays. He decided to move into neurobiology. He became a high energy neurobiologist after that. He likes to say. Scott Fraser was the other one. He had a degree in physics and went into neurobiology and development. You know, he's not just a neurobiologist. He actually studies all sorts of different kinds of development, but mostly of the nervous system. So yeah, you are absolutely right that the kind of thinking that physicists tend to do about dynamics and attractors and big picture stuff is very useful in understanding neural systems, I think. You know, that said, you have to put in the work of learning neurobiology, which is not easy. Scott Fraser and Jerry Pine probably would both tell you, Jerry Pine, if he were still alive, would both tell you that it was a lot of work to learn all that neurobiology after having come from a physics world, but they did it. You know, and as I mentioned before, I'm trying to think of somebody who did the very same thing from a computer science background. And I'm sure there are such people, and probably your listeners will write in comments saying, what about so-and-so? And I'll slap my forehead, of course. But honestly, there are very few examples of people who started with computer science and really did well in neurobiology. Maybe Terry Sanofsky, I'm not sure what his original background was, but he certainly succeeded tremendously in neurobiology, and artificial neural networks was a big deal for him at the early stages.
That's true. Well, you hear that, listeners, that's a call to action from Steve himself. You can reach out to me on Twitter. You're not so active on Twitter these days, are you?
I never have been active on Twitter. I just occasionally post something about my maker activities, but you know, Twitter came into its current extreme level of use by scientists, I suppose, after I started my sabbatical, my maker sabbatical. So that's around when I started using Twitter then.
You mentioned your maker world these days and your lab shutting down a few years ago. What are you up to?
So I'm a freelancer now. I'm living the life of a freelancer in Ireland, really enjoying it. I do consulting for some AI startups and people who are trying to do some of the things that we're talking about here today. I also am writing a book, some of the successes I had with teaching. I did a lot of trying to get my students to do real world experiences, like writing articles for Wikipedia. You know, when I started out, Wikipedia was kind of the Wild West. It was not respected by academics at all. And now, thanks a lot to my students who wrote hundreds of articles on neuroscience topics for Wikipedia, it's pretty well respected and a lot more useful than it used to be.
I thought of you, actually. I was looking up someone on Wikipedia to do a little research, and I noticed the writer of the article was a student. It wasn't one of your students, but I wondered how prevalent that is now, thanks to your real-world teaching that you have implemented.
Yeah, well, in 2006, when I started doing that, there were very few people who were using that as an assignment for students, because people, number one, they didn't respect Wikipedia, and number two, they didn't think that the students ought to waste their time on it, and they thought that it was something that only experts ought to be doing. Well, you know, I had my students study a topic of their choice for a whole semester, and by the end of that, they became an expert in it. They were well qualified to write their articles, and if they weren't, what's cool about this project is that the world will let them know, you know, there are people out there who will just delete everything they wrote. And I had students come into my office in tears saying, you know, someone deleted all my work. And I said, well, you know, they probably had a reason for that. Go ask them why.
Wow.
So anyway, I'm working on this book of real world teaching, and I'm very excited to see that this is kind of spreading. Wikipedia now has all these tools for helping people incorporate that into their curriculum. They have Wikipedia ambassadors. Some of our librarians at Georgia Tech became Wikipedia ambassadors that help teach students how to edit Wikipedia. And there's a lot of mechanisms now that didn't exist when I started that are making it much easier to get involved in that. And I highly recommend it to anyone who either whether you're a teacher or not to edit Wikipedia, because it's really easy to do. And there's so much out there that could use a few little tweaks, not just writing a whole new article, but just tweaking another article to improve it with something that you know about. Go ahead and just give it a try. So I'm also doing a lot of inventing electronics that includes electronics, mechanical engineering, and programming all together, and in some cases woodworking. I do a lot of woodworking.
Do you have a shop in your backyard or what?
I do, yeah. I fixed up the garage to be a woodworking shop, and I have another room that's my invention studio named after the one at Georgia Tech, and you know, it's where I do my soldering and stuff like that.
Did you semi-retire at the right time?
I think so. I mean, everything was going really well for me. The teaching was going really well, and my research, my lab, was actually doing really well. We're publishing some very good papers. These ones on optogenetics that we published at the end, I think, are some of the best work we did. That was work from Ming-Fei Fong and Jonathan Newman, really two fantastic scientists who worked together very closely, one of them doing most of the hardware stuff and the other doing most of the experimental stuff. And they really made a fantastic team. You know, so in many ways, I didn't have any feeling like, oh, I need to get out of here. The thing that drove me out of it was mostly because I had done this sabbatical in the maker movement, and I just was so enamored of every time I went to a maker fair, I just said, these are my people. You know, everybody around me is creative and doing weird things, and there's nothing holding them back, and they're coming up with great stuff. So I said, this is really what I want to do. What I found as a professor, it's like managing a small company. You spend all your time in the office writing grants, and your graduate students are the one doing the fun stuff in the lab. They're the one building the gadgets. And I said, I want to be doing that. I want to be working with my hands, building things. I don't really want to be a manager running the lab and writing grants all the time. Also, grant funding was very hard to come by, especially for these wacky projects that we were always doing. So it was just a constant struggle to keep the lab funded and to keep you know, to keep the momentum going. As I mentioned, there's this problem that good graduate students graduate and then the projects get put on the shelf, you know. So in industry, that won't happen. You know, there's a lot of money. You'll have continuity of projects that'll keep going until they're finished. And, you know, so I think if I were to get back into it in a big way, I would probably join forces with one of these startup companies and, you know, allow them to push the envelope further than they would if they didn't have this kind of neuroscience perspective on board.
Are you still putting on workshops and attending maker fairs? You sound like you are still really busy these days.
Well, yeah, I'm very busy. I definitely haven't slowed down. I think on July the 7th, I'm going to be putting on a HandyBot workshop at TOG, which is the big maker space in Dublin, where I will train a bunch of people how to do first CAD with Fusion 360, which is Autodesk's free to hackers and makers anyway, free CAD pro package that's really good. And I'm just going to show them the basic rudiments necessary to come up with some design that they can carve at the end of the day on the HandyBot, which is actually quite easy to use. The HandyBot, once you've got a design, usually the carving process goes pretty quickly. So I'm going to be teaching a workshop on that. I did one a few weeks ago at another makerspace in Drogheda, a city near me, where it's for retired guys, called the Men's Shed. A bunch of old guys got their favorite team logos and carved them into wood there. So we had a great time.
Nice. So I had heard you say, you know, there's so much going on in the maker movement that neuroscience is still waiting, really, for that big breakthrough, like the next Einstein. And you had mentioned that you thought that could very well come from the maker movement.
Yeah, so I'm glad you asked, because I think one of the things that I'm really excited about lately is this concept of citizen neuroscience. So if you look at astronomy, amateur astronomers have been important in astronomy for a long, long time. They're discovering comets, and, you know, if one of them is probably going to save the planet by letting us know which comet is about to crash into us. Amateur astronomers have done all sorts of useful things by just aiming their own home telescopes up into the sky. I can't really think of an equivalent for amateur neuroscientists. You know, there really just aren't many amateur neuroscientists. There's a few, but times are changing, and it's now possible to buy some equipment that you can do neuroscience with for only $100. For example, Backyard Brains sells kits that you can record your brain waves with. You can record your muscle signals and your heart signals, and you can do all sorts of interesting physiology experiments on insects. Those kits are really cool.
The Backyard Brains, that didn't they start with a device that you can implant into a cockroach brain and control how the cockroach moves?
Yeah, the first one was just to record from the cockroach nerves. And the second one, which I think is probably one of the coolest things you can buy for less than $100 or so, a robo-roach, you know, that you could put on a backpack on a cockroach that you can steer it around with by stimulating its antennae. There are other things I think I'm also excited about to do with electroencephalography. So EEG is fairly easy to do yourself at home without much equipment, very cheap equipment. You can build it yourself. There's a thing called OpenBCI that sells kits that are reasonably cheap, and it's because it's open source. You could build it yourself if you want to and print it on your 3D printer and solder it together yourself. There are a few companies. There's sort of, I don't know what you call these. Maybe they're nonprofits. I'm not sure, but there are organizations that are sort of getting people excited about these new tools and teaching people about what you could do with EEG. For example, NeuroEducate, something Elizabeth Riker is doing. There's one called Sapien Labs, which has really good essays explaining different aspects of EEG and what you can do with it. And so I suspect that because those educating organizations exist, there will be a lot more neuro hackers out there that will be coming from the general public, not from academia, and they will start to make important discoveries. So I'm very excited. I think that's where the aspect of the maker movement that overlaps with my career is this citizen neuroscience, and I'm very excited about that.
Any other projects that you can think of that you have your eye on in the maker space?
Yeah, so the thing that I've been working on in my invention studio is a solar alarm clock that I call Sunrisa to reset your circadian rhythm and keep you on track. So here in the wintertime, the sun doesn't get up until 9 a.m., and in the summertime, it gets up at 5 a.m. So at higher latitudes, the sun is doing crazy things to us who grew up in Southern California like I did.
Right.
And so to keep my circadian rhythm on track, and it's also very useful if you're traveling to different time zones, you might use a solar alarm clock to wake you up an hour earlier every day and reset your circadian rhythm so that when you get to the new time zone, you'll already be in that time zone in terms of your biology. So the thing that's missing from the gadgets that you can go out and buy, there's plenty of sad lamps and lights like this that come on when at a certain time, is brightness. You know, they're just not bright enough. The sun is really bright. People just don't appreciate that. But when I show them my Sunrisa, they all go, ow, that's really bright. You say, that's only about a tenth as bright as the sun. It's not that bright, you know, but they all think that it's freaking bright. You know, it's just way too bright. So I think that this is never going to be a big seller, because I can't get over this hurdle that people have that indoor lighting is not supposed to be as bright as the sun.
That's hilarious.
Only stage performers under spotlights have appreciated lighting that bright.
But you use the device? It's in the making. Are you blogging about it, for instance, or are you keeping the world informed?
I wrote an instructable all about the voltage controller that I used to gradually fade up the light, because it was a very tricky job where I hacked into a power supply. And the power supply was meant only to be controlled by turning knobs on the front of the front panel. And I got the front panel and basically tapped into the wires that go between the front panel and the microprocessor. And now I'm using an Arduino, basically, and my smartphone to control the thing. Neat. Instead of turning knobs on it.
Very good. Well, I have one more question. We are up against time, and I really appreciate all the time that you've spent talking with me, and there's still a ton that we could talk about, so hopefully I can convince you to come back on at a later date.
Yeah, I'd be happy to.
In Ireland recently, the world record was set for most guinea-dipping women in a natural body of water, I think, and I'm just wondering if you enjoyed attending that and if how that experience went.
Yeah, I'm very disappointed that they didn't publicize ahead of time which beach it was going to be on. But it was to raise money for cancer. And the first women that started this, I think, were ones that were, they had mastectomies and were willing to go run into the water naked with their breasts removed and for their, at least, other females to see that. I think men were prohibited from joining in on this event.
I see.
But I think it's a fantastic thing. They beat the Australian record by a huge amount. I think it was like 700 women were the next highest number of skinny dippers that have run into the ocean for more than 5 minutes. And the water was warm there. Here, it's 13 degrees Celsius, which if you're in Fahrenheit, is about like 55 degrees, freezing.
Yeah, well, at least it was for a great cause. Well, Steve Potter, thank you so much for joining me again. And it's been a real pleasure talking to you.
Great. It's been my pleasure, Paul. Thank you for the interview. I think you asked fantastic questions.
All right, guys, that wraps up my conversation with Steve Potter. I'll see you on the next episode. Go out there and create something beautiful.